Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of, and we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and Scream, Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid on Joy 94.9.
This is Sci-Fi and Scream. Welcome to the show. This is episode number 90, number 90, and it's all about some catch-ups, actually. A few interviews I need to play, folk I've been speaking to in the last couple of weeks or so. And I want to say thanks again to TJ and Keza for a great show for White Noise. I caught a bit of that Jimi Hendrix at the end there. Awesome. And that was My Chemical Romance. Yes, Gerard Way and his mates with Sing from the album that came out a bit earlier, Danger Days, The True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys, or My Chemical Romance. Just the message I want to send out is that song I was listening to this morning, and I thought, gee, you know, this is just how we need to be right now, particularly after what happened over the weekend here in Australia, particularly in Sydney, where there was the ALP conference. A lot of the business that I'm talking about is the Equality Act, the Marriage Equality Act, and of same-sex marriage equality, of course, for all people living in Australia. And of course, Sci-Fi and Scream supports 101% same-sex marriage and equal marriage, of course. We'll keep you updated as we go for those of you in Australia, beyond and throughout the many, many galaxies. So tonight I'm going to play an interview with Fiona Trigg, first off, from ACME, and it's all about the Independent Games Festival that begins kicking off actually this month, December the 20th. But next it is indeed my interview with Fiona Trigg, the curator at ACME, and she's talking about a phenomenon called the Independent Games Festival that's going to be playing here in lucky Melbourne town. Take a listen to this. This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Thanks, Sonia. It's good to be here.
The Independent Games Festival for 2011. It's on at ACMI. What can you tell us about that for the IGF?
I'm an assistant curator here at ACME, so I work across a number of different shows, but for the IGF show, I'm putting that show together. So we work pretty closely with the Independent Games Festival, which is based in San Francisco. And every year they have a showcase of amazing, innovative and independently produced video game. And so ACME is taking a selection of the prize winners and the finalists and bringing them to Melbourne and putting them on display in a gallery here that's free to play so people can come along and check out these new games. In 2009 we did a version of the show. We missed it last year, but we're doing it this year and again next year.
Now you've mentioned it comes from San Francisco. Why San Francisco? What was the history there? Do you know why they developed such a program?
Yes, there's a major industry festival called the Game Developers Conference that's held every year in San Francisco, and that's been going for 25 years. And the IGF, the Independent Games Festival, started as a kind of sidebar to that in 1998. And the thinking behind it was a little bit like the Sundance Film Festival, like let's get a forum together for all the people making games who aren't part of the major industry and who don't have that kind of financial backing from the big publisher companies. A lot of the indie developers, they work alone or they've just finished studying, or they are ex-professional game developers who wanted to make their own work. So there's kind of a crossover between art and animation and game design. And so the IGF brings those people together. It has a competition and a kind of festival so they can all meet each other, and there's judges that look at the games, and it gives them a lot of airplay and promotion.
A lot of great things happen in California. I mean, for us here on the show, you know, you've got the San Diego Comic Con.
I think they come from really diverse backgrounds, especially the indie ones. Some of them have been playing games since they were little, and that's all they've ever wanted to do. Other people come from an animation background and decide they want to work in a more interactive kind of way. And of course, recently with the kind of explosion of mobile devices, there's a whole new group of people who are coming in through wanting to work on iPhones and iPads. So it's always sort of changing.
Now, can you tell us about some of the entrants that are going to be displayed and, well, are going to be at ACME?
Yeah, sure. We have 10 games for consoles and 4 games for iPad. And of those 10 games for consoles, they come from all around the world. There's quite a lot of games that come from Northern Europe, like from Sweden and Denmark and the Netherlands. I think there's a little bit of a culture there of independent production and also some government support, which always helps. Yeah, and there's a few games from the USA, a couple from England, one from Australia and one from South Africa.
Wow, so it's pretty diverse, but it is interesting that Northern European interests, or, you know, connection there.
Yes, and some of the more kind of atmospheric and sort of interesting games come from there, like there's one game called Limbo that was actually released the year before, but that has a very kind of spooky feel to it, whereas a little boy wanders through this landscape and there's no dialogue or instructions as to what to do, and you have to help him go through this kind of swamp-like landscape and pass all these puzzles and get to his final destiny. Yes, a lot of them are based around the experience of being in the world that the game developer has created, and they're a little bit like walking through a living animation, some of them. There's another one from the Netherlands called Bohm, B-O-H-M, which is really about just growing a tree, a floating in the heavens, and you have this kind of floating tree structure and you can decide where it shoots out new branches and you can control the speed of that and just kind of spin around it, and it's got beautiful music. So it's more like a meditation than a game where you have a set goal where you have to defeat an enemy or, you know, and a few of the games are like that. They're a bit more experimental than mainstream games.
As far as genre style games, what can you tell us about Amnesia? It seems to be a horror style and Dungeons, which is more fantasy.
Yes, well, Amnesia, The Dark Descent, is a very atmospheric, frightening game to play. I'm from Sweden. And you play a young man called Daniel who wakes up in a castle with no idea how he got there. And it's a very atmospheric game with a very kind of spooky soundtrack. And you have to find your way through the castle, solving puzzles as you go and avoiding the kind of heavy-breathing monsters that are tracking you down, and try and find out why you're in that situation. And it's really a game that's full of atmosphere, and it's very frightening to play.
You've obviously had experience with that one.
Yeah, I haven't gone all the way through it. I'm too scared.
Oh. That's a good sign. Well, maybe not for you, but...
But if you're into horror, that's a good one.
Is that a good one? Oh,
yeah,
I must try that one out. And Dungeons, have you tried that one?
Desktop Dungeons, yeah, that's a kind of quick roguelike game, which kind of comes out of the whole tradition of Dungeons and Dragons. So you play it on a little surface. It's almost like a kind of board game where you move around and you have different monsters that you have to battle with, and there's gold that you can collect, and there are potions, and there are gods, and there's lots of different elves and dwarfs, and everyone has a different kind of value, and you have to negotiate your way through the board and try and collect all the good things and avoid all the bad things.
Hey, this is Joe Cornish, the writer and director of Attack the Block. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hey, I'm Terry Callaghan from Geek Girl Con, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream.
Ooh, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now we're moving on to looking at the Australian content.
Yeah.
It's just one person in there, isn't it? The one game?
Yes, there's only one Australian game that got into the finalists of the Best of the IGF, and that's Antichamber by Alexander Bruce, who's based in Melbourne. And it's an amazing game, and he's been winning awards all over the world. It's a very beautiful game where you explore this kind of 3D geometrical structure. It's kind of a philosophical journey where you unlock puzzles and try and find your way around the game. It has a beautiful ambient soundtrack, and again, there's no real kind of goal other than to work out how that world works and how you can find your way through all these kind of seemingly impenetrable doorways and passageways that eventually open up to you once you've worked out how to get your way through.
So we'll be talking to him a little bit later on.
Oh, that's good.
About Antichamber.
But, you know, Alex is typical of the IGF game makers in that he's done this game basically on his own, you know, and it's a real work of passion. He's poured years of his life into creating these games, and I think a lot of the other games show that same. They're very individual. They're very unlike other games that you've played before, and people can explore new kind of technologies and new ideas in gaming, and it's pretty exciting. Well, I think the IGF is a really great way to, if you've always thought that gaming isn't something you're interested in, the IGF is a really good way to find out about what's happening in kind of contemporary game design, because there are so many different styles that are being explored. And I think with interactive technology becoming more and more prevalent in all areas of our lives, gamers are often kind of leading the way and saying, well, it's possible to make this interactivity really fun, really accessible, really beautiful, and a really kind of sensual experience as well as an intellectual one. If you're not normally thinking of yourself as someone who wants to sit down and kind of shoot people, you might find the games at the IGF of interest. There's a couple of kind of fast-paced, kind of really fun games as well, like Nidhogg, which is like a fencing game with this really funky R&B kind of music where you're just continually killing each other, you know, and get up straight away and kill some more. So there are games like that that kind of do fire up your adrenaline, but even that has a really beautiful sort of graphic quality that may be a little bit at odds with the tradition of fighting game.
Now, how long is it running for, this particular exhibition?
From 20th of December through to the 25th of March next year. And it's free entry and it's open 7 days a week. Actually, after this one finishes, we'll be doing 2012 almost straight away afterwards for another 3 months at Melbourne. So we've basically got 6 months of new games coming up, Gallery 2.
Now, are you yourself involved in, of course, the big one in 2012, and that's the Games Masters? Are you going to be into that one?
Yes, I'm definitely involved in that. We're working on that at the moment, yeah. Yes, that's kind of looking at a whole range of key game designers from the history of game design, not just indies, not just arcades, but some of the major console designers from Japan and the States. And we've got interviews with them on a lot of their development materials, their artwork, a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. So you can kind of learn more about the process of putting games together.
Fantastic. Yeah. And that's from July, is it? Or?
That's right. It starts late 2012. June next year.
Okay. Yeah. How can people find out more about the Independent Games Festival?
They can go to the ACME website, which is acme.net.au, and all the information should be there.
Thanks so much, Fiona.
Thanks, Sonia.
All right. Cool. Thanks very much.
Thanks, bye.
And that was Fiona Trigg from ACME, A-C-M-I, and they're going to be holding the Independent Game Festival for 2011. Like she said, it runs from the 20th December up to the 25th of March of next year, and we are looking forward to Games Masters, which will be part of the ACME Winter Series here in Melbourne, Australia for 2012. There's going to be some awesome guests. I'll put some more stuff of that on our Facebook page. This is Sonia, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
Hi, and welcome to Sci-Fi and Squeam. My name is Nichols Winding Lesson, and this is one of my favorite shows.
For coming on to Sci-Fi and Squeam, Alexander Bruce.
No worries.
Good. And your game is called Antechamber. What can you tell us about that?
Antechamber is a game that is essentially like running around inside an Escher-like world. Geometry and space follow, you know, fairly unfamiliar rules. From a gameplay perspective, it's first person, you're running around solving puzzles, so, you know, I get people comparing it to games like Braid or Portal. One of the key differences in this is that this is a game that's about taking pretty much everything that you understand about previous games and everything that you understand about the world and essentially throwing it out to basically go back to square one and start again with how the world works. It's a fairly abstract kind of thing, but it's the same feeling as going over the seas to a very foreign country like Japan or China. Yeah. A whole lot of what you know about, you know, the world applies in some sense, but most of the time you're just trying to work out how to survive.
One step at a time, I guess.
Yeah.
As far as Antechamber goes, it's an award-winning video game.
It is, yes.
That's pretty exciting. Now, I believe last year you were pipped at the post with Free Play Awards in 2010. You missed out. However, you certainly have made up for it this year. Why do you think that's happened?
Because I've spent another year working on it and it's a far better game this year. Okay. I mean, like, it's plain and simple. I've now spent, you know, I've travelled around the world for 2 years to like 15 conferences and I've watched thousands of people play and I've been adjusting it the whole time.
Tweaking it to perfection. All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, I mean, it had an earlier incarnation, a different name as well.
It did. It used to be called Hazard, The Journey of Life, because it started with the more philosophical and artistic route. And certainly all of that stuff still exists within the game, but it's, you know, all been refined back. My method of design is to go to one extreme and then, you know, reel it in.
What other awards have you won since that time?
Okay, so in Texas last year, I won a technical excellence prize, the grand prize for that competition was $100,000, and unfortunately I didn't get that one, but I'll live and learn. I've been nominated in things in several different countries, so I've had nominations in Japan for Sense of Wonder Night in 2009, which was the first thing that I got. I've had one in China, I've had a whole lot in America, and a couple in Australia.
Now that it's coming to Australia, do you think it's almost like it's had to get all that kind of work or tweaking and evolution to come back now, back home, back in Melbourne, and are you happy with the result, the end result?
Still a work in progress, and, you know, I'm going to be sending them off a new build pretty soon. Every time I submit it to anything, I'm always constantly updating it. So I think even with all of the successes that you get along the way, the fact that it's still not done and it's still in my head is sort of always on my mind. mind a whole lot more than where the game is being shown next.
Non-Euclidean. What made you design your game like that?
That wasn't actually part of the core design to begin with. The game started off as being about geometry, and then I wanted to work out why we would want to use this abstract geometry system that I'd made. That's when, you know, some of the philosophical stuff came in, which is, this is all a little bit abstract, but it made sense as I was going through. So then the philosophical stuff came in, and the game, a lot of it was there, but it wasn't flowing correctly for people. And I had taught them some things in specific areas of the game, and they weren't making that immediate leap that they had to apply it elsewhere in the game. Kind of a naive solution to things. I said, oh, well, I can do whatever the hell I want with space, so I'm just going to connect this puzzle to this one and this one to this one. And as that went on, the world started wrapping around like crazy.
Are you a sci-fi fan? Because this is a sci-fi and horror show. Do you look into science fiction much yourself? Or
not as much as I used to. I've certainly got a hell of a lot less free time these days now that I'm pretty much working 24/7.
Yeah, sounds it. Who did you maybe inspire you? Did anybody or any writers or anything or other games inspire you to make Antechamber?
I'm sure early on there were some things that inspired me. I can't really think back to what a lot of them were at this stage, but from a games perspective, I do know that games like Portal and Braid, although I was working on the game before I found out about them, they were certainly some games that really hammered home the amount of polish that I would have to put into the game to get it up to that sort of standard.
I believe you've got a passion. I've been looking you up online, of course, as you do. You've got a thing about a pink suit. What's that all about?
Did you wear it once
and that was it?
No, I absolutely have a pink suit, and I've worn it to pretty much every conference that I've been to internationally. At GDC 2010, I was giving a talk, and I figured I was pretty much a no one, you know, back then, which is fair enough, everyone has to start somewhere. And I figured people would remember one of three things about it. They would either remember a crazy looking game, or they would remember a really passionate speech about experimentation, or they would remember a dude in a pink suit. So that was the start of it all. And then once I did it once, I decided to just keep showing up at different events because I figured, hey, if they remember a pink suit, they'll remember me.
Not quite a car salesman suit, from what I've seen. A lot more pretty than that. It's cool. Yeah. It's very cool. And what's coming up next for you, Alex? Game design-wise, is there anything you can actually talk about?
In fairly broad terms, looking at creating an installation piece for galleries that requires me to go off and make some custom hardware, which seems like a bit of a leap from where this game started, but it's actually not. They both started off as, you know, one tiny core concept, and then as I was exploring that, they ended up coming into their own. I've been told I'm going to have a lot of people injured playing this game and people passing out, so I've had to work out what kind of installation I would have that in. Padded room.
Pink padded room.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll sign some waivers before they go in. Antechamber?
Yes.
Yes. Well, at the start of the game, I can't say too much about it because obviously a game about discovery, and the more you know, the more it breaks. But the start of the game feels like running around in a bit of a museum, so you don't really have some major interactions, but the basic interactions that you do have are all making some pretty weird stuff happen in the world that people haven't really seen before. And then once people, you know, sort of get comfortable with that and think, okay, I understand the rules of this game, then things take a turn, and then do that several times as the player keeps getting more and more interactions and they realize just how big this world is.
And you spelled it differently from normal Antechamber. What was the reason for that?
When I was going through the name change, I came to, after throwing out a whole lot of suggestions and getting quite frustrated, I came to Chamber because I do have this menu room that I called the Hollow Chamber at the time, and I was going to call it Chamber, but then I was thinking about that. That didn't seem strong enough, and then Antechamber, you know, seemed like an even cooler word to use, and it was fitting thematically. If you hear someone say Antechamber, a lot of people, when I said that, would hear it with an I, and they would hear me saying Antichamber. When they read it with an E, they would stumble all over the word. They didn't really know, you know, what it was. So I changed it to the I to get a bit of a dual meaning in there. Antichamber and Antechamber are both very thematically relevant to the game.
Great idea, definitely. Now, it's going to be at the IGF, the Independent Game Festival.
They've had the best of the IGF in Sydney and Brisbane recently, and now it's coming to Melbourne.
Are you going anywhere else after this with the game? Or
I am. The IGF, the actual IGF, this is the best of the IGF, so the IGF is actually run in San Francisco, part of the Game Developers Conference, and then each year they go through and they pick some of the best games from that were shown at the IGF to play around various locations. So I'm going to be going to San Francisco in March and then PAX East in April, which is in Boston. And then by then, hopefully the game is done and finished and people can buy it. It's been long enough,
Yeah. Right, look, hey, it's fantastic talking to you this evening for Sci-Fi and Squeam. We wish you all the best, Alexander, or Alex.
All right, thank you. Yeah,
and,
either way.
Yeah, I hope the suit holds up. For many more
conferences, events.
Yeah. So they're more conferences, not conventions. Is that right? That's the difference, is it, in gaming? Or
I wouldn't have a clue. I'm sure I've been to some of both.
All right, thanks for talking to us.
All right, cool. Thank you.
Congratulations. Thanks for talking to us. Bye.
Hi there. This is Anna Silk, and I play Bo on Lost Girl, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
Hi, guys. This is Eddie McClintock. I play Agent Pete Latimer on Sci-Fi's Warehouse 13, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on 94.9.
Hi, this is Isabel Carmody with Sonia on Joy 94.9, and the program is Sci-Fi and Squeam.
Yes, it is. It's Sonia here. This is Sci-Fi and Squeam. And that piece of music, if you can call it that, was by Blazer Force, or a.k.a. Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords. Those incorrigible Kiwis. What next? That was Electronic Santa, and it was with DJ Seraphin, and it was the clean 12-inch mix, whatever that means. Cool. So getting a bit into the Christmas spirit. And prior to that, we had, of course, Alex Bruce, who is definitely the les enfants terribles of independent or indie games. And those are video games that are definitely pretty different. They're not the usual shoot, kill, explode, and dissipate. So he's going to have his game Antichamber, which is non-Euclidean, if you know what that means. It's a geometry style that often makes appearances in works like sci-fi fiction and fantasy, including H.G. Wells. He talked about it in one of his short stories called The Remarkable Case of Davidson's Eyes. If you want to find out more about Antichamber with an eye, definitely head on down to Acme this summer. So that's going till March, from the 20th of December. All right, now I've got an interview with Isabel Carmody next, the wonderful woman fantasy writer, the very famous sci-fi fantasy dystopical writer who was in Melbourne recently, end of October, early November, for her new book. It is The Sending. So let's check that out. Have a listen to that. And I did play some music from Braid, which is one of the games that Alex Bruce mentioned earlier in that interview with him. This is Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. Sci-Fi and Squeam, Isabel Carmody. It's great to have you on the show this evening. As I mentioned off air, we're a bit of a mixed bag, our show. It's a mixture of different genre. And I haven't touched on fantasy a lot. So you're one of the first. You're doing a real whirlwind, almost a junket, I guess, promoting the latest book, book number 6, and it's The Sending. Now, it's part of the Chronicles, and I'm not even going to try and pronounce it.
Oba Newton.
Part of the Oba Newton Chronicles, book number 6. How is it going? You've been running around like crazy promoting it.
I was in Hong Kong for a few days promoting it, and then a couple of days ago I landed in Melbourne. Then I was taken off to Tasmania, and today Melbourne, tomorrow Sydney, the next day
goodness
up north. So it's a matter of getting to an airport and thinking, where am I again?
Maybe you should have a little tag saying you are now in.
Yeah, I need a sign. I need, when you come out of the airport, they should have a flashing sign saying you are here in wherever.
This is you. From your own website, I've been investigating, you see, it says, Isabel began the first of her highly acclaimed Oba Newton, Newton Chronicles, while you were still a young lady at high school, and you worked on it while completing a Bachelor of Arts, and then you did a journalism cadetship. So this is quite an expanse of time.
Mm.
Why has it taken so long? I know that you've done heaps of other works, more than 30 titles, I believe, altogether.
Yeah, more than 30 books. Mm. I started writing Oba Newton when I was 14. I was 14. I was a misfit, as every 14-year-old is, trying to figure out how to be myself and yet how to be part of the world. I lived in a world, like all teenagers do, made of the choices of adults. And I don't just mean physical choices like where you live and what school you go to and who's your mother and father, but the choices that they've made in their life, which create a metaphysical environment, which is to say their disappointments, their fears, their angers, their sorrows. You grow up in that world too. And none of it is your making, and it shapes you. But in one minute, you're going to be free of it, and you're going to inherit the earth, whatever mess has been made of it by adults.
Right.
So that's where I started. started to write at 14. 14, I wasn't writing to be published. I grew up in a housing commission area. Mm. Never occurred to me that a kid like me could ever write a book. I actually thought all writers were dead people, famous dead people. I was writing for myself, writing to figure out questions that mattered to me. And sometimes I'm asked, do you really think kids think about these questions? I definitely think kids think about it. What I worry about is adults perhaps don't think about it enough. Oh, yes. Like, why are we here? And all of these big questions you ask yourself at midnight sometimes when you're in university. Mm. Kids ask them too, and they're worried. You know, if you go into a school now, you'll find that kids will write essays about, you know, global warming and deforestation and, yes, and the rape of the seas. You read about this from in their work. That's what they're worried about.
And cyberbullying is another one too.
Yeah,
that's quite
all of these things. Yeah. So their questions are really big, and they don't have the answers, of course. And they think, they hope that adults will have the answers, but they know they don't have all of the information. And at some point, I think while I was writing about it, I was thinking about the world. I was thinking the bombs dropped on Nagasaki, and those are the solutions that that adults had to problems in the world, which seemed barbaric to me at 14. They still feel pretty barbaric to me.
Yes.
But back then, I thought there must be a good reason. Somebody must know. I knew that I didn't know much. I knew my mother, who was an adult, knew very little too. It seemed to me you needed to be educated to learn more, and you needed to find the places in the world, the jobs in the world, where people knew more. So being educated was going through school, and all of the time I was just writing for myself, and learning more was becoming a journalist. Thought journalists who tell the world about things, they must know more. And it's true that they do. But when I was a journalist, what I was learning was facts. Facts and truth are not always and are very often not the same thing at all. And it seemed to me that when I went home at night to work on my story, I was closer to truth, whatever truth was, truth with a capital T or truth. So in all those years I was writing for myself, I was learning to write. It wasn't until I was, you know, I was a journalist and my editor said to me one day, do you ever think of getting, writing, you know, those stories you write, of getting them published? I never did, but I did then. And so that's why it took such a long time. I wasn't writing to be published. I was learning to write, and I was learning to be a person who felt that I could actually put my voice out in the world and get published.
It's incredible, because you've crossed over, I noticed, into different areas. Obviously written, yes, as you say, for yourself, but this is something that has become a fruitful endeavor as well. And you've been able to go into the worlds of young people's writing or young adult fiction, but you've also looked at writing for adults too, and you've done picture books. I mean, you've illustrated, I believe, some of these books yourself. You've really run the course of a full creator, not just a writer.
Well, I think it's that
you do it yourself, and that's amazing.
I think it's that all of those things, including fantasy itself, they're all tools in which to try and answer those big questions, which I was just trying to ask at 14. Questions like, is it possible for human beings to evolve ethically and morally? That's really what the Over Newton Chronicles is about.
Right.
My attempt to find out if I could believe that. It wasn't an attempt to make other people, you know, to find a solution I could offer to the world and to advise the world. It was me trying to figure it out for myself. But at some point when I did put it out there in the world, it was acceptable. And people align very strongly. And I think the reason they align is not because I'm offering a solution, but because I echo their own concerns.
Mm.
And so they can feel someone else in the world is worried about the same kinds of things.
Hello. This is Lawrence R. Harvey, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 949.
Hi, Pollyanna McIntosh. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
I'm Darren from the DK comic published by Dark Oz, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
Yes, welcome back to Sci-Fi and Squeam here on Joy 94.9, and I'll continue the rest of that interview with the wonderful fantasy writer, the awesome Australian woman, the pioneer herself, 36 years plus she's been working on these chronicles. That is the one and only Isabel Carmody, and I want to thank Penguin Publishing for enabling me to have her here in the studio a few weeks back. Now, that piece of music prior to that, look, a little bit of Christmas cheer, perhaps on a cooler week this week here in Melbourne in Australia, and that was 53 seconds of The First Noel by Sufjan Stevens from his Christmas album that he brought out a few years back. Interesting man indeed. And let us know what you think if you're an Isabel Carmody fan, if you're a gamer fan, what your Christmas wishes are for this year, for 2011 and the new year ahead, 2012. Anyway, back to the interview with Isabel. This is Sonia, and you're listening to me on Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. No, you probably get asked this heaps of times, but for our listeners, can you briefly give us a synopsis of the latest book, The Sending?
Well, overall, the series is about Elspeth, who's born into a world after a nuclear holocaust. Most of the world is radioactive black wastelands. Elspeth, when she starts, is about 13 or 14. She has telepathy and various other mental abilities. She can communicate with animals mentally. And her overall quest is to try and find what she calls the weapon machines, which is in fact computers, and switch them off to make sure they don't do the full job the next time round. What I was trying to do was to find out if human beings, after the ultimate lesson, could learn from it. Would they learn from it? And Elspeth's my vehicle for the question in some ways. And in this book, she finally leaves Obernewton, which has been a place of, gone through many incarnations, from being a place that she was, where children were experimented on, to being which is a refuge. And she leaves it in this book finally, partway through, to pursue the final stage of her quest. She has most of the things she needs now. If you think about it, she's like a 14th century person being asked to solve questions on a computer. You were from the 14th century. You wouldn't know what a computer was. If someone says you need the key, you would imagine a key that locks a door. But the physical keys on a computer are the things you press, and you can say, I'm keying it in, or you can say a key on a map. Yeah. So she spends a lot of time trying to understand what it is that these weapon machines do. They've got lost archaic technology, which is in fact our technology, that she's trying to unweave, figure out how to use it. So of course she has to invent a mythology around it in order to be able to operate it or to understand it. So a lot of the book is her gathering the tools she needs to finally deal with it. She doesn't obviously get to the end in this book because there's one more to come. So this is the main thing that happens in this book, other than personally to her, is that she leaves Obernewton and she truly goes from there forever. So.
Because I did notice on Facebook today, there was on the Penguin site, Penguin page, and they were saying people put questions in, and it seemed to be a little bit of a theme of some of your fans or followers or readers were concerned that this was the last one, but there's going to be more.
There is the one more, and there's always the perception when you've written a number of books that it's going to go on forever, like Robert Jordan's Circle of Time. But the thing is, he just opened that series out and kept inventing characters, new scenarios, and no matter how inventive you are, at some point you want the story to circle into, you want it to complete itself, you want a sense of completion. For me, the completion really is in the next book. And I think someone said to me today, is it going to be a happy or a sad ending? And I said, well, are you always happy? No.
No.
Are you always sad? Are you sometimes sad? Yes. And this is the truth of life. There is darkness in life, there's light in life, there's happiness, there's sadness. And when you come to the end of a series, I'm coming to the end of a series that has spanned my life, and I'm sad. I also want the sense of completion, and therefore the story will suck up those things and represent them in some way. Sadness and the feeling of completion, the feeling of ending, and the feeling hopefully of uplifting as well. All of those things will come and be somehow played out in the final book.
Just like life.
Just like
the journey of life.
And because it's that truth that you're looking for. It should represent itself.
It should. Things don't always end abruptly, but sometimes there is closure and there is then obviously the next chapter of a person's life.
Yeah. I always figure that I don't want to die because then I have to not know what's going to happen next. And there's all sorts of things, and I think, well, I won't be around to see that, you know, when this happens or when that happens. And I think in a way a book that ends should have that sense of incompletion, that sense of, damn, I really wish I would have known what would happen.
Yes.
So I think you have to feel a certain amount of a book's really good of hanging on to the end of it. It's like when you read something you really love, you roar to the end, and then you know the worst moment is going to come when you finish it and you know you've got to the end. Well, you can always read it again, I guess.
But with a trilogy, or in this case, I don't know, what do you call six?
Six.
It just keeps going. And I think that's really great that you've been able to keep that momentum, and plus doing all your other stories that you do and all these awards. I mean, they're coming thick and fast. There's such a big list of awards. I really don't know if I can have the time to read them out.
Please don't read them all.
Okay, I won't start then. You have said that writing fantasy is like conscious dreaming. Well, that's what I read, that you've said that.
No, that's absolutely true.
And so that's lovely. I mean, you've pretty much explained that already to me, what you mean by that. What does it mean, though, do you think? If you could say what you're consciously dreaming and you're putting it in words, how would you do that?
It means that if you're trying to think about something, it's a form of thinking. When you dream, if you dream, you're not in control of it in general. You dream and images fall through your mind and pictures, and you have meetings, you have regurgitations of daytime life. None of it's controlled. But when you're writing, you do have some control over that dreaming. So you induce this in yourself. I mean, Ursula Le Guin has used this beautiful phrase to write about it, gave a name of, she named a book A Wave in the Mind. And the words Wave in the Mind come from Virginia Woolf writing about, saying that a writer is always looking for the wave in the mind. And you know, when you're in the water and you're in the sea and there's those swells that come and they lift you off your feet and they bring you, move you forward. Ones that bring you in, because then there's this, or even, even take you out, but they move you.
They do.
And I think when you're lifted off your feet and that sense of being moved, I think that's what you're looking for as a writer. So the conscious dreaming is looking for the wave in the mind, the thing that will carry you forward or in whatever direction, to the shore or out to sea, but the thing that will carry you. So you do have an element of dreaming, which is this real drawing on subconscious. I do anyway. I think fantasy does. I think that's why it's a huge genre, even though there's a lot of rubbish written in it, which is mostly people who don't understand what it's all about, trying to, you know, let's invent a fantasy. So we'll have a road, we'll have...
Contrived,
we'll have the, we'll have the stalwart dwarf, the ethereal elf, we'll have the princess in disguise, all those usual tropes.
Yes.
But they're not saying anything with those things. What you're saying, it has to rise from something, something that you're really trying to say, some connection to you. And I think so when you're consciously dreaming as a writer, writing fantasy is about trying to tap into those themes which are your themes, allow them to flow out, and looking for the thing that will lift you up. And for me, fantasy is the thing that lifts me off the ground and moves me forward and lets me go somewhere, but I don't quite know where I'm going to be going or where it's going to carry me or how far. But it's that dreamy sense of being lifted and that sense of letting your consciousness flow through you. I think you feel that as a writer.
And you seem to trust it, like you're not afraid of that. I don't get a sense when you're speaking now that in any way does that concern you, where it might take you, somewhere totally different. You seem to feel quite secure and trusting in that creative movement and development.
Yeah, it's a great point to make, actually, because I have written 30 books, but two or three books in, I wasn't so secure and I wasn't so confident. I didn't know what the flow was. I didn't know what I was looking for. What I did know was that I love to tell a story. I love to follow the story. Mm. It's like reading a book that you like, writing one. It's that you want to see what's going to happen next because you don't know. Someone told me this lovely story today about Tolkien, who someone came in when he was writing the second book in his trilogy and said to him, "So how's that story you're writing going?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he pushed back and he has a suck on his pipe and he says... He says, well, I don't know, but these black riders have just ridden in and I don't know what they're about. And I just had to laugh.
Hi, this is Oscar Hillstrom and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
Yes, Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. I hope you're enjoying the very long interview I had with Isabel Carmody. But seriously, folks, she is probably one of the most awarded fantasy writers from born and bred in Australia. She sold in excess of 240,000 copies in Australia alone, just of the Obernewton Chronicles. I can never say that right. So anyway, the story of Elspeth Gordy continues. And then I asked Isabel pretty much about, well... something I was very interested in, and that was her actual living, residing in Prague. So we'll finish off the interview that I had with Isabel, then we'll just have to wrap the show, I think, for the evening. So you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam, and this is definitely Joy 94.9. Sometimes you live on Ocean Road, is that right?
Yeah, I live on the Great Ocean Road part of the time. But in general, at the moment, I'm living in Prague in Eastern Europe.
Yes.
Pretty much full time at the moment. In a couple of years, we'll be back in Australia.
Because I was going to ask you about Prague, of course. Prague's always been interesting to me because of its background, because of the culture and the different layers of history. Some of it pretty, you know...
dark.
Huge, incredible and barbaric, and others of it really enlightening.
Yeah.
Like they have the oldest known university in Central and Eastern Europe, the Charles University there. They had probably one of the most extensive and fruitful and well-established Jewish, Yiddish culture as well. And of course, the famous...
Well, they eradicated it.
And they did have, the bad bits of, obviously, that does happen, unfortunately. But they also have the old new synagogue, it's called, where the Golem story was supposed to have originated. From the very famous one.
Incredible place.
Have you been there?
Yeah. All of these places you're talking about are very... I pass them like to get milk. But that's how I live, right sort of in the centre.
It's an
incredible place to live. And you're right, all of that feeds in. It's almost like a steampunk fairy tale, to live in the middle of a steampunk fairy tale, because you have that fairy tale quality of cobbled, twisty little streets.
Gothic
a castle,
buildings.
You can see gothic buildings, and a black river with this stone bridge over it. But you also have Nazi graffiti on the walls.
Nice.
And you have really tough, scary people walking down in the street, and you have a lot of alcoholism, you have a lot of people in the street, you know, barbaric politics, a lot of the time you have rough, raw, brutal capitalism in its early phases.
Mm.
And yet behind that was kind of a pure form of communism or socialism, which never, you know, it was an idea which never really
lived. The Velvet Revolution.
Yeah, you're in buildings where there's a hole where someone says, oh, that's where the secret police used to have their microphone.
Yes.
You talk to someone at a dinner table who halfway through a funny story, you notice their fingernail is missing and you hear later on they had them torn out at some point. So it's really living in the middle of a strange kind of place.
Interesting.
And it's fascinating to be
a writer.
You
had Franz Kafka was from there and Metamorphosis he wrote there. And the question is, how much is that inspiring you now, do you think, in your work?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all of the Little First series came out of the 400-year flood that happened there when the whole city was flooded. The story came out of the aftermath of that. And Greylands very much came out of when I first lived there. I've got some short stories coming out in a collection. One of them is called Man Who Lost His Shadow. And that story is set very much it's set in Prague. Metro Winds is set in Prague. So, it feeds very much into what I've written. I'm not sure whether it will continue to do so. I think the longer you live in a place, the less you see it clearly.
Yeah.
And even though I'm trying to stay a stranger in a strange land, in that I still don't speak the language very clearly and I don't want to, you pick up habit, and the minute you start to form habits, you're starting to form a comfort zone.
Yeah.
And a writer should always be a little bit outside of a comfort zone. You strip off a skin and you become more sensitive, and I think that's when a writer's really seeing and really taking in the world, and therefore will be able to express it in their writing.
Beautiful. I'm going to have to wrap it up. And they are beautiful covers, of course.
They are. Kathy did a fantastic
job. Kathy Larson. I'll do a plug for her because she's part of Spaced Out, which is the LGBTIQ group fan club. And
she must have torn her hair out sometimes dealing with me, but she's she really persisted until she got exact. And she's such a perfectionist.
I can see that.
Put into the covers. I thought she just got a person holding a cat and took a picture. I didn't realise how much goes into
that. I wonder if that was her cat.
No, she stalked a cat in the street and got a stranger's cat. She asked the owner.
Yes.
She brought the terrified cat home in a basket into the studio to be photographed.
Well, congratulations on the book. It looks beautiful. I'm going to have to dig into it a bit more, and I might have to even go back, travel in time, and actually start reading from the beginning. Thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Isabel Carmody, it's been an honour to have you here on Sci-Fi and Scream. Thank you.
Hi, this is Isabel Carmody with Sonia, Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
And this is the end of Sci-Fi and Scream for another episode, episode 90, number 90. Thanks again to Isabel Carmody, Kathy from the one and only LGBTIQ Sci-Fi Club. And that reminds me, Outland is coming. Yes, folks, Outland, a comedy about a gay science fiction fan club, is coming to our very own Auntie TV, or ABC to you and I. And it's going to be awesome. It's about the lives, the loves, and the never-ending dramas of the five members of this very interesting sci-fi club, because it's gay, but they're more worried about coming out as sci-fi geeks. What do you know? So it's by writer John Richards and the fabulous Adam Richard as well, directed by Kevin Carlin, producer is Andrea Denholm and Laura Waters, and it's out by Princess Pictures. So we look forward to that in February. More of that on our Facebook. Just head to Sci-Fi and Scream on Facebook or Sci-Fi and Scream blogspot.com, and you can go to the Joy site as well, joy.org.au. Well, that's the end of the show, and I just want to say thanks to Acme and all the folk from IGF, Alex Bruce and Fiona Trigg as well, hearing all about some alternative games out there. Next week, it's all about dystopical classics, classical music that is, and opera, and what we would like to see, our sort of science fiction horror symphonies. And my special guest will be the Queen of the Night himself, and that's Tim Perry, Joy's own Tim Perry, will be joining me, so it's going to be a little bit of a sci-fi indulgence, but with science fiction opera. Cool. All right, join us next week. That's Tuesday the 13th. Thanks for listening.
Vampires, zombies, ghouls and creatures from outer space. No, it's not Federal Parliament. It's Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with Joy.